This is Clusterfucked. Here's your host, Roger King.
Thanks for clicking play on yet another fine episode of Clusterfucked. I'm Roger King. Today we're making a slight exception. As you know, the tagline of the podcast is a liberal host, but with red state guests. So the full confession is that my guest today is not in a red state. He's in California, but he is from St. Louis, so maybe we can, you know, figure it out that way and we'll get to past the judges. But anyway, Jonathan Roden is a professor of political science at Stanford University and also a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. He's the author of a book that came out this year called Why Cities Lose: The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. And I need to read the teaser about this book, and you'll understand why Jonathan is joining me on the podcast. Why is it so much easier for the Democratic Party to win the national popular vote than to build and maintain a majority in Congress? Why can Democrats sweep statewide offices in places like Pennsylvania and Michigan, yet fail to take control of the same state's legislatures? Many place exclusive blame on partisan gerrymandering and voter suppression, but as political scientist Jonathan Roden demonstrates in Why Cities Lose, the left electoral challenges have deeper roots in economic and political geography. In the late 19th century, support for the left began to cluster, I repeat, cluster in cities among the industrial working class. I'm clearly emphasizing the word cluster, but the description of Jonathan's book goes on. The left-wing parties have become coalitions of diverse urban interest groups, from racial minorities to the creative class. These parties win big in urban districts, but they struggle to capture the suburban and rural seats necessary for legislative majorities. I guess we could quibble a little bit because 2018 showed the Democrats starting to make headway in the suburbs. We'll talk about that in a second. Anyway, possibly the longest preamble Jonathan has ever heard before he's finally able to say something. Jonathan, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I do think I haven't looked at the index, but I'm pretty sure the word cluster does show up in the book quite a lot.
Good. That's why you're so on target for this podcast, as we talked about. I wanted to say off the top, one thing that was intriguing to me about that description that I just read was the mention of gerrymandering and voter suppression. These are two things that a lot of people on the left claim is, you know, the reason the Democrats don't win more elections. I'm not going to lead the witness here, but how serious do you think those issues are, gerrymandering and voter suppression, when compared to liberal clustering in terms of why Democrats don't win more elections?
Well, I think those are serious issues, and I've been involved in trying to understand them and trying to measure them. But I think it's a mistake to think that those are the only issues, and that the problems we witness in the distribution of Democrats across districts, it's a mistake to assume that can be explained by gerrymandering alone, because it has implications for how we think about redistricting reform.
Right. And I mean, obviously, you know, they are serious issues, but I mean, you can't gerrymander a Senate race or the presidency. So, you know, there's more to it. I guess the premise of your book is essentially that clustering is one of the key factors, correct?
Right. And one of the things I try to do, it can be hard at times in a book that has so much going on, but one of the things I try to do is introduce some subtlety to this, in that there are some states where the problem of clustering is much greater than others. And there are some states where it really is the case, I think, that gerrymandering explains a big part of what we see. And so part of what I'm trying to do is disentangle some of that. I think North Carolina is a state where it's hard to understand what we're seeing in terms of votes and seats without looking at gerrymandering.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, I wanted to sort of dive in a little bit on these coalitions that are sort of mentioned off the top in terms of the quote from the opening about the suburban voters and that sort of thing. I guess we can take the suburban voters first. I mentioned that Democrats certainly made some headway in 2018 in the midterms. I think Trump is repelling a lot of those voters in the suburbs. Is that your assessment? We'll start with the suburbs, and then there's another coalition I wanted to talk to you about as well.
Yes, I mean, throughout the book, the advantage that Republicans get from this political geography really involves the fact that they're able to win a lot of suburban seats by a comfortable but not overwhelming majority. That's always been the key. Democrats are so concentrated in cities, and the Democratic reputation in some ways is shaped by their urban incumbents, and this gives Republicans advantages in these suburban seats. Then the big question in 2018, of course, is whether that, you know, do we want to think of what happened in those 2018 suburban seats as a kind of a one-time reaction to, or, you know, revulsion to this particular president, or is that the beginning of a longer-term trend? Is that the beginning of the kind of a slipping away of certain suburbs from the Republican Party? And it's just too early to be able to make that assessment, I think, right now.
Yeah, we'll have to see where it goes. Obviously, if Trump loses, I think the Republican Party, it'll be a real, I mean, I've been sort of predicting a civil war that was brewing between them, and he may have accelerated this. I don't know, but you're right. We'll have to see how they do in 2020 and in the suburbs and how Trump does and all of that. The other group, though, that they tended to get, at least in recent times, were the college-educated voters. And, you know, I think that's surprising to liberals sometimes. I think they think of college-educated, they're thinking, you know, say Stanford and some of the other universities in California and New York and Boston or whatever. But of course, you know, someone who graduates from, say, Jerry Falwell University would also be considered a college-educated voter. And so I wondered, as a political scientist, have you seen what defines college-educated voters change over the years, and what's your assessment of, you know, where that voting block is going?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's certainly the case that the relationship between college education and voting has changed dramatically over time. You know, in the 70s, it was a pretty good bet. You know, college education was a good predictor of Republican voting. And that it's been slowly changing over time. But one of the things I'm interested in is the extent to which that is changing in a regionally specific way. And one of the things I'm looking at in the book, and, you know, I've started to provide some answers, but I think there's a lot more to try to understand here, is that, you know, an educated suburbanite in Boston or Seattle or San Francisco is very different than someone with similar demographics and education in Cincinnati or, for that matter, St. Louis. And so what is the explanation for that? I think, you know, part of the answer is you already kind of suggested that a graduate of Stanford is probably a little bit different politically than a graduate of Oklahoma State. So there's, you know, there are really important variations there. But I focus a lot on the sector, on the knowledge economy sector of employment, and the fact that there are some cities that have these suburbs that are really composed of people who moved to those places from elsewhere to take up opportunities in the knowledge economy sector. And that's kind of what the suburbs of Seattle and San Francisco and Boston look like. And that's very different than the suburbs of St. Louis and Cincinnati, which are places where people who live in those suburbs pretty much grew up in those suburbs or elsewhere within that metro area. That's a really big difference.
Yeah, and that's getting to, you know, what I wanted to talk a little bit more about in terms of clustering, because on this podcast I talk about, you know, two kinds of clustering. There's the literal clustering, where people are choosing to live, and then there's the figurative clustering, which is, you know, sometimes liberals spending too much time talking to people who already agree with them and not enough time trying to persuade those who don't. We'll get to that in a second, but in terms of, you know, what you just said in terms of the literal clustering, I openly advocate here, you know, for liberals to literally move to red states or districts if possible, in an effort to slowly change some of the numbers, if, you know, if they're in a position to do so. So I sort of joke that it should be a new liberal movement that's literal. But do you actually see that happening to some degree? I asked this partly, you know, sort of what you just said, but also you were in another interview where you were talking about some of the fastest growing communities in the U.S. and how some of the housing issues in terms of affordability, et cetera, in some of the major liberal American cities are actually having kind of an unintended consequence, or, you know, benefit, I guess we'd say, to the Democrats, of people choosing to move elsewhere. Can you speak to that a little bit, and are you seeing that?
Yeah, I wrote a little bit about that in the conclusion when I was kind of thinking about the future, and it's something I'd like to look at even a little more closely in the future. But certainly, if we just look at the counties that are growing most rapidly, I think there's a misperception that everybody's moving to these big knowledge economy cities. But some of those places are really, some of them are gaining population, but in many cases, we're just not building enough housing to facilitate that. And the housing is too expensive, and people are increasingly moving to places like the exurbs of Houston and Orlando and Phoenix. And so, the future of American urban form is not necessarily growing density in city centers. We're still spreading ourselves out more and more in space over time, and that means places that were formerly red-leaning, like exurban Houston, are now becoming more heterogeneous. The fastest growing places tend to be places that are becoming more politically heterogeneous. It's not the case that blue places are just becoming much more blue.
Right. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of talk now about Texas potentially being in play for the Democrats, and we've talked about it on this podcast a bit. Of course, Beto O'Rourke came close last time and kind of might have, sped up the process. But, I think you're also mentioning Arizona as well. That's a place that we might look at where Democrats might gain some ground this next election, would you say?
Yes, I mean, we focus on, everybody focuses on the state level, of course, because we're all obsessed with electoral votes, and to some extent, people care about Senate seats. But there's also this other kind of subtlety to it, which is if we care about congressional seats and about state legislative seats, there is a potential for a kind of declustering as people seek out housing and schools that meet their preferences, and labor market opportunities. A lot of people on the left and right are looking for similar things, and they're going to end up selecting similar kinds of communities. And so we might end up in places like Texas and Arizona and Florida, not only with the whole state trending toward the Democrats, but also with the suburban communities becoming more competitive, becoming more potential pickups for the Democrats in those suburbs and even the exurbs.
Right, and so that's kind of the literal clustering, or trying to address that. And now on the figurative side, I think you, towards the end of your book, you were talking about, I'm not sure if you actually phrased it this way, but, there's that huge debate that continues to play out in the Democratic Party between, progressives who want to go big and they want candidates to push big ideas, big changes to the country. But it has not been proven yet that some of these progressive ideas can move voters and be popular in some of the moderate and even red districts that Democrats need to win in order to get those majorities we talked about. So it's that battle where sometimes it feels like the progressives are not taking into account our actual electoral system and some of these things we're talking about. So do you see basically for the near future, Democrats still needing to make a play to moderates because of the way things are set up and because of this clustering that we're talking about?
Yeah, I think just from what I've seen in looking at survey data at the level of districts, and I think we're getting better at collecting bigger and bigger surveys and getting more observations where we can characterize people's preferences within congressional districts. It appears to be the case that progressives are quite clustered in cities. It's not just Democrats who are clustered, it's progressives. And so it may be that with a really kind of left-leaning platform that is tailored toward urban voters, if one can really maximize urban turnout, there are maybe a few pivotal states where that kind of a strategy statewide could be successful. And so there's a lot of talk about that. There's a lot of focus on that. Well, is it possible, perhaps, with a surprisingly left-oriented strategy, is it possible to win statewide? And it may or may not be. It's not clear to me. But what is clear to me is that is a strategy that is not well-crafted to win the median congressional district in a state or the median state Senate district. Those are places that are ideologically quite distinctive from the urban districts. And so if the Democrats choose a platform that really is meant to kind of maximize urban turnout, that might be fine for statewide elections, but it's probably not going to work out so well in trying to control legislatures.
Yeah, and we've seen the frustration that some progressives have with, you know, the so-called blue dog Democrats or whatever who vote in a certain way, but they're just reflecting some of these more moderate red states. It's not, you know, rocket science what's going on. And I always talk about trying to persuade voters, and I think that sometimes to some on the left, in their mind, means, you know, trying to find common ground, and then they interpret finding common ground as either pandering to some of these voters or even, you know, surrendering your principles in some way. And I think it's more about just persuading folks to, you know, to come on board liberal side of thinking rather than, you know, any kind of surrender of principles and that sort of thing. So I think Democrats probably could do a lot more of that, but it may happen because of what you're talking about, where they're moving into some of these districts and it will influence them politically, I think, at least.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's kind of complicated is you know, how people learn lessons from what they've seen. And so perhaps 2018 there's a question about what kind of lessons people might draw from 2018. And if the lesson people draw is, hey, everything's fine, there's really not a problem in trying to win Congress. We've kind of, the Democrats have figured that out. I think they might learn otherwise once Trump is gone, and I mean, who knows what comes next. But one of the lessons I think that people haven't learned so well is just to kind of look back historically at, you know, how did the Democrats manage to kind of, you know, I guess one of the things I show in the book is this geography problem is pretty old. It's been around for a long time, but the Democrats have been able to manage it. And the question is, how did they do so? And I think they did it by allowing their candidates to run on all sorts of different platforms in suburban and even rural districts. The party has been many things to many people for much of its history. And that's how they managed to control Congress for so much of the post-war period. But now in this era of highly nationalized politics, and where every congressional election is viewed as a battle for control of the legislative chamber, the candidates are really held to very high standards in terms of ideological purity. That's what kind of creates this geography problem that the Democrats are facing.
Well, and I mean, I guess the simple summation of what you were talking about going back is all politics are local, but now it doesn't. Would you say that adage is dead? It was weird because in 2018, the Democrats did run a lot of sort of local races, and they didn't even talk about Trump much in a lot of cases, and they just talked about healthcare and things that were, you know, for that state or that district or whatever. At the same time, though, as you say, it's sort of been nationalized. Do you think all politics is local still applies?
Well, I think it's something that it may be that the Democrats might find that by trying to make politics a bit more local, they'll find their path to success. And I think there's some indication, as you say, that 2018 that was part of what made them successful in places like Oklahoma City and Salt Lake City and so forth.
Yeah. Now, before we wrap here, you know, in the last part of your book, of course, you sort of look to the future and what solutions there might be to sort of combat this clustering issue. Now, of course, there's another debate raging about the Electoral College, given, you know, Trump, like George W. Bush before him, won the presidency without winning the popular vote. So there's a whole debate about whether we should abolish it. Love to know where you sort of stand on that, but also what else you would like to see happen in terms of electoral changes that, you know, in an ideal America.
Well, yeah, I guess that the last phrase there is the crucial one.
That's the key I'm giving you. You know,
are we trying to be realists or look at the world as it is?
Let's do both. How about
when I look? You know, one of the things I do in the book is tell a big historical story about the rise of proportional representation in Europe and explain why that happened and some of the implications of that. But also more recently, I look at New Zealand, a place where a transition to proportional representation, a kind of a mixed system where they retained winner-take-all districts for some legislative seats, but then introduce an upper proportional tier that has increased the number of parties. And it's there have been a couple of attempts since then to put it back on the have new referenda, and voters have voted to retain the proportional system. So New Zealand is an interesting example of a place where this kind of reform was possible, but it was made possible by the ability to make use of the referendum process. So I think a lot of Americans are in favor of breaking the monopoly of the two-party system, and especially young people are overwhelmingly in favor of that. And so the way to achieve that is with electoral reform, something like experiments with reforms like that used in New Zealand. But Americans are very are not fond of proportional representation, evidently. Mm-hmm. And the strange thing, it's really in some ways the people that have the most to gain from it are the kind of center right older school Republicans who've kind of seen their influence wane. And they've been kind of squeezed out by the populists. So it's not really necessarily an ideological thing. I think there are lots of people who have views that don't fit very well into either of these two very diverse, kind of strange bundles that we have to choose from. I think a greater variety of choices in the party system is something that lots of people would support. But somehow getting people interested in electoral reform is a real challenge.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, actually, the center right that you refer to, sometimes you find people perhaps the most opposed to these changes in that group of voters. Certainly, the Electoral College, for example. What were your thoughts in the Electoral College, by the way, in terms of abolishing it, and what kind of an idea that would be?
Well, yeah, I think it's a very odd way to choose a president, and it's not lots of things in the U.S. Constitution that other countries have copied, but no one has seen fit to copy that one. And I think there's a good reason for it. It's just a very unusual and difficult, in my mind, to justify way of choosing a national chief executive.
Well, especially if you told people that someone got 3 million more votes in an election and lost, it would be bizarre to almost any other country.
Yes, I mean, that's the case that when we have majoritarian, winner take all systems, sometimes the winner is not the party that has the most votes. And in fact, that did happen in New Zealand, and that's a big part of why they changed their electoral system. There were two elections in a row where the Labour Party won the most votes but did not win the most seats, in part because of clustering, because Labour voters were so concentrated in cities. So it's a good example of a place that had this kind of crisis and was able to work their way out of it. It's worth pointing out that it wasn't really the Labour Party that was so excited about reform, even though it lost from the existing rules. One of the things that the Labour Party was worried about is a switch to a more proportional system would help the Greens and other competitors on the left, and it has had that effect. So we can't assume that it's the Democrats who we would rely on to pursue electoral reform, because the Democrats incumbents are some of the folks who have something to lose. So it's really got to be, if reform is to happen, it would need to be a kind of a cross-party or nonpartisan kind of citizens approach.
Yeah, yeah. Good luck with that.
Yeah, exactly.
In the short term, but we brought it back to clustering, and that's great. So the book is Why Cities Lose, and actually, I guess going to your website would be a good idea, Jonathan. So it's jonathanroden.com, correct?
Yes.
Yes, and that's spelled R-O-D-D-E-N, jonathanroden.com. Jonathan, I enjoyed covering some good ground here. Thanks a lot for coming on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So again, that website is jonathanroden.com, R-O-D-D-E-N, if you want to have a look at the book Why Cities Lose and see what other political science work Jonathan is up to. Speaking of websites, how about visiting cfthepodcast.com? That's where you can listen to other episodes of Clusterfucked and find out more about the show, cfthepodcast.com. We have a mailing list there. I think it's at the bottom of the homepage. Please join it. We love it when you sign up, no charge, of course. And and we can keep in touch that way and update you on future episodes and anything else that's going on at CF headquarters. And there is a support the podcast button to click on as well. Appreciate the donations. We have some expenses running this enterprise, including the lovely recording studio that I'm talking in right now, dbaudio.ca, and, website hosting and design expenses. So if you'd like to support the podcast, we appreciate it. Just click on support the podcast at cfthepodcast.com. And we are on Facebook as well. Do a search of CF the podcast. And I'm on Twitter. I'm the civil liberal, but the handle is at CF the podcast. So yeah, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. We love it all. We love communicating with you in whatever way we can. Thanks for listening.
The Clusterfuck Podcast, a liberal host with red state guests.
This is Roger King. That'll be all.